Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We are talking about Anna Karenina, which is a book we're reading. Which chapter of Anna Karenina, you ask? Well, I'm glad you asked, because I'm about to tell you which chapter we're talking about. It is part 5, chapter 8. Was your stalling detector going off then? It should have been. Okay. Vronsly, it's a bit of a Freudian slip, is desiring desire. Oh dear. And is apparently a good painter. Nice. Vronsky doesn't want to be with Anna. Couldn't you see it a mile away? That's... Ooh, got the hiccups all of a sudden. That's what I reckon, at least. Does anyone else think the same? Thermos of Beer said, I might have missed something here, but how can Anna and Vronsky afford to travel abroad and rent a palazzo? Last I remembered, Vronsky was in debt and couldn't afford to take care of Anna and himself, and now he's no longer serving in the military, so he's got no paycheck. But they seem to be faring just fine. Did I miss something? Oh, God. Sorry, I've got some kind of hiccup cough thing. Corsio said, I won't be surprised if his life as a private person, even with rented Italian palazzo, is less expensive than his high society life. Offices and court duties and drunk parties in Petersburg. Today, a villa in Europe may cost less than an apartment in downtown Moscow. Deep Con said, I may be wrong on this, but I think it was mentioned that the military post is a lot about power and position. Some of them actually had to pay subsidize their division. I thought that I read that a few chapters back. I don't remember that exactly, but yeah, I think their concept of being broke and in debt is a lot different to ours. Like, they're still high society, right? So, being in a big amount of debt, it's like, yeah, they've still got money at hand, though. Like, they're not broke. That's what I think. I think it's a different type of wealth. These are the wealthiest people in Moscow. I am Norwegian said, uh-oh, is he going to turn into a Stepan after all? Or move on like Alexei feared? He's 100% going to move on. Or he's just going to be miserable and like passive-aggressive because he doesn't really want to be with her. 2. He is a good painter, but I wonder how long it's going to keep him busy. The last part of the chapter does mention that he doesn't paint from the soul, that he doesn't get inspired by life. If it's a hobby and not a passion, he might get restless quickly. I think he already is restless, and this is like a desperate attempt to distract himself from his restlessness. Ander, how is it going to work with A Year of War and Peace and this subreddit eventually reaching the same book? It's going to be a bit of an overkill, no? No, I think you're right. I think it is a bit of an overkill. I don't know, to be honest. You know what I'd love to do? I would love to figure out a way to time it so that we finish a book at like the end of December and then start A Year of War and Peace and just do it in parallel with the A Year of War and Peace subreddit. We could even like, I don't know, how would that work? Would you cross post it or would you just jump over to that subreddit for the 1 year it will take to read that book? It takes a year to read just that book. Or do we just leave War and Peace out of this project? Or do we just do it whenever we get to it and have some kind of weird echo crossover where we're out of sync with A Year of War and Peace but reading A War and Peace over the space of a year? I don't know. Which of those do you think is the best way forward? I think, really, I think it doesn't matter. That's what I really think. I think it doesn't matter. We'll decide on one of those options. Really, those are really the only options. But either way, we're going to read all the books that are on Hemingway's list. We're going to discuss them in a daily chapter at a time format with basically the same community, either here or there. Their community is a bit bigger. But there's, you know, certainly a whole lot of crossover. So, yeah, I mean, What do you guys think? I'd love to know. But I'm not stressed about it because, to be honest, any of those options I think is a good option. We get to experience all the great literature that's on Hemingway's list. We get to experience the great works of Tolstoy as well. So any and all of them work for me. Here's my dream. This is what I would love to happen. Over the space of next year, I endeavor to finish my new translation of War and Peace, the Andrew Lewis Bogan translation of War and Peace. That's what I want to do. And then time it out so that the Hemingway list, whatever books we're reading, end, one of the books ends at the end of December, and then we start a year of War and Peace on the 1st of January, and the book that I will read as the podcast will be my Bogan translation. That's my dream. That's my dream. I don't think, like, there's a lot of things in there that probably won't happen. A lot of parts to that puzzle that might not pan out. I mean, for starters, I'm not even sure if there's another year's worth of books left in the Hemingway list without, not including War and Peace. I've got no idea, actually. There might be more. There might be two more years. I really don't know how it's going to, like, how long the rest of the books are. But yeah, wouldn't that be cool? I think that would be cool. But is that kind of too, like, egocentric to read your own translation of the book? But I suppose if it's your own translation, then, like, you're going to like it. So that's the one you're going to want to read. And I would also use it, reading my own translation out loud, as a vehicle through which to further proofread the book, you know? Like, every day when I sit down to read that chapter, and we all read that chapter, any typos we notice, or, you know, things that need to be scrubbed up a little bit, we can do it. Minor things, you know, you might find the odd typo here or there, or the comma in the wrong place, or that kind of stuff. You know, after any first edition of a book, you're going to find little things like that. So it's a good chance to, it'll be a good way to vet for those things. All right, that's my dream. Probably not very realistic, but that I would love to see happen. Okay, that's the conversation done. That is the conversation done. It is now time to read chapter 9. Part 5, chapter 9. Let's have a little look here. I'm just looking to see. Oh, it's pretty short. It's a 3-pager. Another 3 pages today. All right. The neglected old palazzo, with its high stucco ceilings, its walls, frescoes, and mosaic floors, with heavy yellow damask hangings at the big big windows, vases standing on brackets, and mantel shelves, carved doors, and somber halls filled with pictures. That palazzo, when they had moved into it, by its very appearance kept alive in Vronsky the pleasant delusion that he was not so much a Russian landowner and inquiry without a post as an enlightened connoisseur and art patron, and withal a modest artist himself, who had renounced the world, his connections and ambitions, for the sake of the woman he loved. The role Vronsky had chosen with their removal to the palazzo was quite successful, and having through Golinishev made the acquaintance of several interesting persons, he felt tranquil for a time. He painted studies from nature under the direction of an Italian professor, and studied Italian life in the Middle Ages. Medieval Italian life had at that time become so fascinating to him that he even began to wear his hat and throw his cloak across his shoulder in a medieval manner, which was very becoming to him. "Here we live and know nothing," said Vronsky one morning to Golinishev, who had come to see him. "Have you seen Mikhailov's picture?" And he passed his visitor a Russian newspaper that had just arrived, and pointed to an article on the Russian artist who was living in that town and had just finished a picture long talked of and bought before completion. The article reproached the government and the academy for leaving a remarkable artist without encouragement or help. I have, answered Golenishev. Of course, he is not without talent, but his tendency is quite a false one. He has that Ivanov Strauss Renan attitude toward Christ and religious art. What is the subject of his picture? Asked Anna. Christ before Pilate. Christ is pictured as a Jew with all the realism of the new school. Led on by this question about the subject of the picture to one of his favourite topics, he began to explain. I can't understand how one can make so gross an error. In the art of the old masters, Christ was given a definite embodiment. Therefore, if they want to depict not God, but a revolutionary or a sage, let them choose some historic character, Socrates, Franklin, Charlotte Corday, but certainly not Christ. They chose the one person who must not be chosen as a subject for art, And it is true that this Mikhailov is so poor, inquired Vronsky, thinking that he, as a Russian mecenas, ought to help this artist, regardless of whether his picture was good or bad. Hardly. He is a wonderful portrait painter. Have you seen his portrait of Vasily Chikova? But it seems he does not want to paint any more portraits, so it is possible he may be in want. I say that. Couldn't one ask him to paint Anna Arkadyevna's portrait? Said Vronsky. Why mine? Said Anna. After the one you painted, I want no other. Better have one of Annie's, as she called her little girl. There she is, she added, looking from the window at the beautiful Italian nurse who had taken the baby into the garden, and then immediately glancing around at Vronsky. The beautiful nurse whose head Vronsky was painting for his picture was the only and secret sorrow of Anna's life. Vronsky painted her, admired her beauty and her medievalness, and Anna dared not confess to herself that she was afraid of being jealous of the nurse, so she treated the woman with special kindness and spoilt her and her little son. Vronsky, too, looked out of the window and into Anna's eyes and at once turned to Golenishev, saying, Do you know this Mikhailov? I have met him, but he is a crank and quite uneducated. You know, he is one of those heathenish new folk one so often meets nowadays, you know. One of those free thinkers who have been brought up from the beginning in disbelief, negation, and materialism. Formerly, Golenishev went on, either not noticing or not wishing to notice that both Anna and Vronsky wanted to speak. Formerly, a free thinker was a man brought up with ideas of religion, law, and morality, who himself, through struggle and pain, had attained freedom of thought, but now a new type of born free thinkers has appeared. These grow up without so much as hearing that there used to be laws of morality and religion, and that there was once authority in these things. They grow up simply with the idea of negation, that is, as heathens. He is one of these. He is the son of a head footman, I think, and has had no education. When he entered the academy and won a reputation for himself, he, not being stupid, wanted to get some education. So he resorted to what seemed to him to be the wellspring of education, the magazines. You see, for merely a man who wished to get an education, a Frenchman, let us say, would have commenced studying all the classics, theologians, dramatists, historians, and philosophers, and with what mental labour he would have been confronted. But among us, at the present day, he tumbled straight into the literature of negation and rapidly assimilated the essence of the negative teaching, and there he was. And that is not all. 20 years ago, he would have found in that kind of literature signs of the struggle with authority and of an outlook centuries old, and from that struggle would have deduced that something else had existed, but as it is, he stumbles on a kind of literature that does not even deign to dispute the old point of view, saying straight off there is nothing but evolution, selection, the struggle for existence, and nothing more. In my article I... Do you know what we'll do? Cried Anna, who for some time had been furtively exchanging looks with Vronsky, and knew that the latter was not at all interested in the education of the artist, but was only concerned to help him by giving him a commission for a portrait. Do you know what we'll do? She resolutely interrupted Golenishev, who was in the full flow of his speech. Let us go and see him. Golinishev pulled himself up and unwillingly agreed, but as the artist lived in a distant part of the town, they decided to hire a carriage. An hour later, Anna, seated beside Golinishev with Vronsky facing them, drove to a new ugly house in a distant quarter of the town. Having learned from the house porter's wife, who came out to meet them, that Mikhailov allowed visitors into his studio, but was at that moment at his lodgings a few steps away, they sent her with their cards to beg permission to see his pictures. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. I'm loving this bit of the book. This is like the Italian artist bohemian section of the book. We're just in Italy making art, hanging out with artists. I love it. This is good. This is good. I am thoroughly enjoying it. And like, I want to meet this artist and see his paintings in the next chapter. So, hell yeah. Go Tolstoy. This book just like ticked up to me for like, you know, from the 3-ish out of 5 that it was on up. I mean, I'm up to about 3.5 now because I'm enjoying this little Italian getaway. All right. Thank you very much for listening. You might have noticed, by the way, there was a little update podcast uploaded just before. Have a listen to that if you're curious for a bit of an update about that Bogan War and Peace thing. I did ramble a little bit because I didn't really know what I wanted to say, so I just switched on the microphone and started talking. So I apologize for that. But I got my point across, so all good. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.